Welcome to Ojibwe Stories, Gaganunida. I'm your host, Eric Reddix. We're in the high summer months, so we thought we'd reflect today on the winter months that are coming all too soon. We're having a conversation about winter living and language with Gordon Jourdain, who grew up in the Ojibwe community of Lac La Croix in northwest Ontario.
I guess what comes to mind all the time is what we human beings talk about all the time when we meet each other is Aninejuweba Kaguching. I just talked about just generally what people talk about these days, I guess, is just how the weather is like outside. And we had a different fall and we're having a different winter right now. During the time of the freezing month, this would be normally we would expect to have some kind of ice formation on the waters, but that didn't happen right away. And, of course, we haven't had a lot of snow, thankfully. Knock on wood. I was really looking forward to go snowshoeing during the Christmas holidays, but I don't have enough snow at home to go walking in the woods. It's just been recently where we had a little bit of snow, and now we have a lot of cold. It's cold, so that's basically what an observation, I guess, that I've made from the year last year when we had a whole bunch of snow by this time last year. And I'm thankful because I've only had the snow blow my driveway once so far. I'm a hockey fan, of course. Grew up watching hockey all the time on TV, playing hockey. And, of course, we never had any of the equipment that they have these days or even what I have now in my I still have my hockey bag, by the way. Still ready to go. A friend of mine, when we were kids, we wanted to play hockey so bad, but we didn't have access to any anything at all. So,
equipment, but, teams, anything.
Back at the reservation, they had a store, and they still have that store about 3 miles down the lake. That's where my parents and everybody else would get the necessities, you know, just sugar and flour and none of the extra things. So because there wasn't refrigeration there, they'd buy this carnation evaporated milk and he opened it with a can opener and just pour it out. It's really good with tea. Yeah, but they would throw those cans away and my friend Eugene and I would step on them and kind of hit them so that they would form over our shoes and we try to skate with those. That's the closest we came to a pair of skates. And then we just cut like curved sticks like this, opposite of a cane, kind of shave it so that it would look like a hockey stick. Just recently I saw on a what's that show? Native Report. There's a report there about Lac La Croix Indian ponies. And because the community where I grew up is Lac La Croix, and we used to have those ponies there. And I remember them as a kid because my aunt had some. My grandmother had some. My grandmother's pony was called Bijikins. My cousin's pony was called Gugajins. Real old-time Ojibwe words. But they'd leave horse dung all over. And because we lacked pucks, we were never short of hockey pucks. We used the horse manure for hockey pucks and play. And we'd never, ever run out of hockey pucks ever.
And it had to be like a deep freeze, like...
Winter,
you don't want it like 30 degrees.
No, you wouldn't want to be a goaltender then. Then we used two rocks for posts. And we'd play along the river every day after school. We'd try and go and play for an extra 20 minutes, little bit of daylight we had left, and then we played all day Saturday and Sunday. It wasn't until I was probably 15 years old when I got my first real hockey stick. By then we had skates, and very rarely would we have a real puck. Mm-hmm. We'd always lose them anyway because they'd go into the river.
Hmm.
If you shot it too hard and you didn't get...
There's no net.
Yeah, there's no net. And there's no boards or anything. It just plop right into the river. So it was a lot of fun.
So how'd you get around then, like in your childhood? Was there lots of cars around or...
There was not one single car there. No road. There were trails. The horses that I'm talking about would have trails in the forest, real nice and packed trails. Mm-hmm. And of course, we'd have family trails too, where we went to go and cut wood and stuff. There'd be trails from house to house. And that's about it. There was nothing at all for structure. Yeah. It wasn't until 1995 when they built the road in there. That's, 20 years ago? That's the first time a lot of the people saw any kind of vehicle.
Mm-hmm. And how does that impact language? I mean, today, are young people intergenerationally, do parents speak to their kids in Ojibwe, grandparents? Where is that kind of, is there a cutoff?
Wow, that's really interesting. Of course, I don't spend a lot of time back there, but some of the families are really, really... And good for them. They still speak Ojibwe with their children and their grandchildren. Most of the kids still speak Ojibwe, but a majority of them, I don't want to even take a guess, don't speak Ojibwe anymore. Because probably there's not a need for them to learn that language anymore. Well, they feel they don't need to. I always thought that Kakijiwanung, the reservation where I grew up, would be a perfect place for an immersion school.
Mm-hmm. Do you think there's a broader knowledge base, though, starting out, that you as a teacher would be able to get onto and then take to another level? Or
I would think so, because a lot of the people there, about 25 and older, still speak Ojibwe.
Right.
And compared to where I'm teaching right now, the only place where the children hear Ojibwe is in the classroom.
Right.
It's not in the community or any of the families that have their children at the school. Although they put up a valiant effort taking Ojibwe later in their lives, some of the families do that. I think that it would actually be beneficial if you have the community speaking Ojibwe, the target language.
What's kind of the answer to that then, as far as those challenges? Like, how do we get parents so they're more engaged with, that's a challenge for anybody in education, but especially something like Ojibwe, if it's just 6-7 hours of Ojibwe every day and then nothing when they go home.
Yeah. I recently read an article and I'm always reading articles because that's my passion is the language. They're doing a longitudinal study of the effect of English in a 20-year study in Nova Scotia. I think it's in Nova Scotia.
Mm-hmm.
And the language is Mi'kmaq. The one class is 100% Mi'kmaq immersion. The other class, they take Mi'kmaq, they study it. I don't know what the percentages are, but maybe like an hour or 2 hours a day. And the kids are tested on their English ability and also on their Mi'kmaq ability. The group that took Mi'kmaq, as you can expect, their Mi'kmaq was higher than the students who took it an hour or 2 hours a day. But surprisingly, the English was comparable. The children who were immersed in Mi'kmaq all day, their English levels were the same as the children who were instructed in English all day. So there was not a loss in their first language because English is all over. As soon as they step out of the classroom, like we're talking about, it's there. The bus driver speaks it, the taxi driver or the janitor. It's at home, it's in the community. So in essence, the community maintains the English levels in the children.
Hmm. Another challenge too is when Ojibwe is taught, and is there a certain kind of standardization that might be happening? Or, I mean, we kind of touched on this before, but things like accents, because, you know, what I hear with older young adults learning languages, and I'm guilty of this myself, is that they tend to speak very English Ojibwe. you know, it's very heavy English accent. So what's your advice for language learners to kind of get past that? So we have an accent that's maybe rooted in somewhere where we're from or in something.
I really believe that it's in the way it's written out. Mm-hmm. So when you have a standard system like the Fierro system, and you write it the way that it does, everybody's going to talk the same way. The accents are going to be the same. It is a good way to do it. I like the Fierro system myself. I use that rather than the phonetic system, because English is an extremely complicated language.
Mm-hmm.
And it takes a lifetime to get to know how to spell, even in English, or even how to...
More than a lifetime.
For some.
I still can't spell.
It takes a long time to be able to do that.
Mm-hmm.
And if we expect our kids to either recognize, read, or write English at an early age, it's almost impossible to expect that from them. The best way, I would think, is to use that kind of academic Ojibwe language as a foundation for you to go and visit the elders who have, you know, the enunciation, they have all that, the inflections in Ojibwe, to go and spend some time with them.
Mm-hmm.
Ojibwe is fun, and we always laugh, and not to be too serious about saying something that may not sound correct to an elder, it's fun. I think if you have that kind of outlook early, you'd be successful in producing a reasonably native-like accent.
Native-like.
Anishinaabe-esque. Yeah. I used to live in Hayward when I first came down here. And I was watching hockey at the rink.
The sports side.
High school hockey, yeah. And I was up against the glass doing the color commentary in Ojibwe. And I didn't know that one of the fathers from the reservation there was listening to me. He goes, "Oh my God, that was pretty good." He said, "I never heard an Ojibwe commentator." But in Ontario, they have Wawate News, and they have color commentators doing the native hockey tournaments there.
Huh.
They have a lot of hockey tournaments there in March. The kids from K to 12 have the same week off all across Canada. A lot of the teams are really young kids to probably high school level. And there's over 120 teams that play, and they're all native kids. Mm-hmm. And they're girls and boys. Spend a whole week in southern Ontario there, around Sudbury, I think, and they play hockey.
Huh.
And that's it. And then they go back to school after.
Huh. That's cool.
Yeah, it is really cool. A lot of really good native hockey players. And I'm not one of them. That's why I teach Ojibwe.
This is Ojibwe Stories Gaganunida, a program of Ojibwe culture. Our guest today is Gordon Jourdain, who grew up in the Ojibwe community of Lac La Croix in northwest Ontario. Today we're having a conversation about winter living and language. Did you want to talk a little bit about family growing up and what changed?
Cutting wood was everything was a family occasion. From the preparation of not even the day before, but at least a week before, my parents and my brothers and everybody that I lived with would prepare for the activity of getting wood in the forest for the coming weekend. And we always would look forward to doing that. My mother would tell us stories about people in their life and how they did a long time ago. She would also make moccasins for us, really basic ones, mm-hmm. and things that she would whip up in a couple hours. And you can't wear those until it's really, really cold. Otherwise, you're gonna get soggy. Yeah, they're not waterproof. Your feet will freeze. But everything would lead up to that activity of cutting wood. Everything would just build up. Mm. All the excitement would build up. Couldn't hardly sleep the night before. In the morning, we'd get up before the sun comes, and we'd have a hearty breakfast. And my mother would say, you'll be strong in pulling the sleigh when if you eat this and those oatmeal, this porridge. And then we'd all eat that, and then we'd all go into the woods and spend the whole day there cutting wood. We'd be hauling.
And all in Ojibwe.
All in Ojibwe. Hmm. Everything was done in Ojibwe. Not a word of English ever. And then we'd come home the day, but before it was over. We'd talk about what we did. We'd laugh and haul it the next day by snowmobile.
Chainsaws?
Yeah.
Okay.
That was an excellent opportunity for me to tell you a story there.
Yeah?
Yeah, to kind of make it more colorful. My mother would, in the fall, she would just use that old, I think they call them sweet saw. Are you familiar with those? It's just a piece of metal like this. It's like tubular.
The ones that are...
It's flat.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's a blade that is stretched out at the bottom.
Mm-hmm.
And you just, she'd hand cut all the wood.
Huh.
And not really big things, but probably like this, so that I could carry them down to the river and put them in the canoe. And I'd paddle them back and forth.
Huh.
From, gotta be at least a mile down the river.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd paddle up river with a canoe full of wood.
Huh.
Take it out. And by the time I got to where she was, there was another pile left on the river. Just like that. It was, she got all the wood in the fall. Because my dad and my brothers would be out trapping before the ice froze.
Huh.
Different times of the year. And in the spring, too, they'd leave. They'd walk out to where the trapping line was.
Mm.
And then they'd come up the river in canoes when the rivers opened up with their hides and ready for sale.
Huh. But the women did the...
The wood cutting.
The wood cutting.
Mm-hmm. Didn't mess with the women then.
Wow, there's still a few you don't mess with. But.
Yeah, she would split the wood. She would also haul water.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, it's traditionally that's the gift of women to take care of water. So she knew all those things. And that's how we lived. Our upbringing was extremely reliant on what was happening outside, the different changes of the season.
So water, you had to cut a hole in the lake or the river?
Yeah, the Waige.
Huh.
Cut a hole in the river, and she used to put an old tub on top of it so it wouldn't freeze.
Huh.
Or the dogs wouldn't go into the water hole.
Yeah, and no Brita? No water filter?
No.
Huh, right out of the...
Right out of the river, and the river was probably where my dad's house was. It was like less than, not 50 feet.
Hmm.
But the river would hardly ever froze because it was a fast-moving river.
Yeah.
It was only when times were really cold, like today, where it would at least have a film of ice on top of it. Huh. So it wasn't really hard to get chop it off.
Yep.
Go right to the edge where it was a little thinner and chop it off.
Huh.
Chop a hole in the ice. And we never had electricity. Never had electricity, indoor plumbing. Electricity didn't come to that community until, I think it was 1974.
Huh.
Way before my time. And that was really strange.
Mm-hmm.
The very first time I experienced electricity, I walked into the room and I'd like turn it on and off, and I'm like, oh, wow, how does that work? It was amazing. But prior to that, my dad was pretty, industrious.
Mm-hmm.
He had like propane lights that he would, there was just one light on the kitchen side and another light on the living room side where he would go and just turn it on and poof.
Boy, that's tough, though, to think about, especially like that first couple of weeks in December. And it's probably worse up there. There's probably less daylight by a few minutes.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
Well, I mean, it's still like that now. It's, good 16 hours of darkness now. Yeah. So,
well, we gained like about 15-16 minutes since the winter solstice of daylight. So,
yeah, but still, long winter nights.
During that time in that fall, that I don't know if we ever talked about it. There's like 2 to 3 weeks of a window where the travel would be impossible in the fall, and then in the spring again.
Right.
In the fall is during ice formation.
Yeah. Just a little bit, but not enough to
Not enough to land a plane there.
Oh yeah. Yep.
And what I was talking about today and in previous shows was they had to get ready all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And what told them what to get ready for was usually the moon.
Mm-hmm.
If the moon that's coming up is Kashkadnugis, you better get ready for that because it's going to happen during that time.
Mm-hmm.
And if you don't, you're out of luck. You don't have a lot of those things.
Yeah.
And another time is in the spring when it's ice out. It's not enough. The ice is not strong enough to land a plane.
But it's still there, so
it's still there, so you can,
can't have a watercraft. Yeah.
So it was during those times where people, it was really, really different then.
Mm-hmm.
People were really energetic and visiting and doing a lot of things.
Huh.
There'd be a square dances almost every night, and people would gather up at the old gym and play guitars and sing. And it was really active that way. The human interaction when you're totally closed in and not able to go anywhere, you have to be able to be very creative in using whatever energy you have left to entertain yourself and hear the people that you live with in the community. It was extremely I really liked growing up there. It was a nice community to grow up in.
And I'm kind of curious, just kind of a side note about the square dance stuff, like, is it like you think about like old gym class with like where they play those, well, this is dating me to a certain time, but we used to have these square dance records where it was like a record, you know, and this is in the 80s, so people were, you know, trying to listen to like Michael Jackson and stuff. Yeah. But so it was like kind of out of left field where they would play these square dance records. Was it something like that, or was it more like
it was a live band?
Oh, it was a live band.
Yeah.
Huh.
Almost everybody played some kind of instrument there.
And that's just something else you would, like, trade supplies for? Because, I mean, you know, just like you were talking about hockey, you know, I mean, musician stuff, that stuff's expensive, and, guitar strings and whatnot.
Well, they didn't have really, really, well, of course, they didn't have electronic stuff.
Then. Unplugged.
Unplugged. Just a fiddle,
yep.
Acoustic guitars, and later on, when the electricity came in there, well, they had to mic the fiddle and stuff like that. It was fun.
Huh.
Yeah. It was really fun. Even took, when I was in high school there, they had a high school there from, so I went to school there from K to 12, and I never went anywhere. That's where I went to school.
Mm-hmm.
We took square dance lessons in school. That's when they used to have the whole records there.
Yep.
So we could practice, or I think they had tapes then, cassette tapes.
Mm-hmm.
But the people who were playing in the cassette tape were the people that played at night.
Hmm.
They were people from the community. Our teacher would probably just record them with his little cassette player.
Hmm.
And then we'd dance to those. Fun. Of course, they had ceremonies and formal ceremonies, of course.
Right.
Seasonal ceremonies. And then they had other different things. We played a lot of sports too.
Mm.
Did a lot of hunting and fishing. There was hardly enough time to rest.
So you weren't bored?
We were never bored, no.
Huh. That's cool.
Yeah. But I don't know if I have that energy yet if I went back there.
That's all the time we have today. I want to thank our guest Gordon Jourdain for sharing his stories with us. This is Ojibwe Stories Gaganunanida. I'm your host, Eric Reddix. To listen again to past episodes of the program online, visit the program page at kumd.org and click on Ojibwe Stories. Ojibwe Stories Gaganunanida is produced by KUMD and the Tribal Sovereignty Institute at the University of Minnesota Duluth, home of the Master of Tribal Administration and Governance, or MTAG, program, where students learn about leadership, law, sovereignty, and management from a tribal perspective. MTAG was designed by tribes for tribes, currently accepting applications for fall enrollment. More information can be found at umdmtag.org. Funding for Ojibwe Stories Gaganunanida is provided in part by the UMD College of Education and Human Service Professions and by the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund.